You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 21st, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hi.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So welcome back, Kara. You were away last week. Yeah, tell us what happened. Why were you away?
So last week, I won an award, which was cool.
Congratulations.
Thank you. You know, we record on Wednesdays, so I couldn't record because I was either on a plane. No, I was actually at the award ceremony during the time we would record. It was for the CUNY Journalism School and the Knight Foundation. This is the third year that they have given the Knight Innovation Award, and they actually awarded that to Neil deGrasse Tyson. And included in the Knight Innovation Award is a secondary award called the Give Forward Award. And in that award, the person who wins the Innovation Award is supposed to choose somebody to give forward to, and Neil selected me. So he won a $25,000 award, and I won a $25,000 award, which is freaking
wow.
awesome.
That is awesome,
Kara. That is awesome.
Well-deserved.
Oh,
and you missed the show for that.
I know, right? I'm excited because I have a dedicated office / podcast studio in that house. And so I will be able to upgrade all the equipment, put up some soundproofing, and really make it into a much more professional studio, unlike the dining room that I'm recording from right now.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of you.
Yeah, that is awesome. So while you were getting an award, I had jury duty this week.
Oh, no.
Oh, shit.
Jury duty, what is it?
Did you actually have to serve?
No.
Oh, okay.
There's zero chance. So I had every confidence that I would be out of there. I did get all the way to voir dire, and it was for a murder trial.
Ooh.
Whoa. So you would have been stuck for a long time.
They were estimating like three weeks.
Gosh. You know, she said, what are your feelings about scientific evidence? And that was my opening.
2 hours later.
It's like, here's my
So I gave her a very quick spiel about, well, you know, I would do a science podcast. I'm on president of the Skeptical Society. All you have to do is say that word skeptic and you're out.
Yeah, that's what I did.
The magic
word.
They went
through the motions. They asked me all the standard questions. And then they send you into the back room while they deliberate. So literally my ass didn't touch the seat and they came back for me. It's like, we won't be using you for this trial. I mean, it was so fast. Aww. It was like an instant nope. It was funny. But I was thinking about it. You know, I probably would not be a good person to be on a jury. When you think about it, especially like in a murder trial, the prosecuting attorney absolutely should not want me on that jury because all you really need is reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
It'd be
like 12 Angry Men. You'd be like that one guy.
Mm-hmm. But think about it. It's really hard for a skeptic to get beyond that reasonable doubt because if it's going to trial, you know there's no smoking gun. Because if there were a smoking gun, they would be settling.
He would get a guilty plea out of him.
Yeah, so there's got to be only circumstantial evidence, the kind of evidence that we're all skeptical of, right? Eyewitness testimony, probably some BS forensics that's really under a lot of criticism for being fairly dubious, and it would be hard for me to get beyond reasonable doubt with that kind of wishy-washy evidence, the kind that would be in a local trial like this. So, yeah, I thought about it afterwards. Like, yeah, the prosecutor was right not to want me on that jury. Mm-hmm.
Don't you have the curiosity, though, of what it would be like to go through the process? Because I know I've felt that way. And if I had the time and availability to do it, I don't think I would mind doing it because I would really like to see how the whole thing plays out
and be a part of that. I got to fight a traffic ticket once. In court, and it was just, there was no jury, obviously. It was just me against the prosecutor, and they had the cop as a witness. And the prosecutor actually pulled me to the side afterwards and, gave me props. She was like, what do you study in school? You should study law. I was like, holy shit, this is so cool. It was really fun.
Traffic ticket, huh?
Yeah, it was for a red light. And I was, really pissed.
They dropped the ticket?
I was sued.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's different. That's less fun.
Trump's your traffic ticket.
Fuck
it. Maybe.
So today is Back to the Future Day.
Yay!
October 21st, 2015.
Back to the future.
Unbelievable. I can't believe all that time.
We're going to talk about that at the end of the news. Just to let you know, that's coming up. This is the date that Marty McFly went back to the future in the second movie. But we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, Bob, you're going to tell us about the Forgotten Superhero of Science.
For this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Maria Sibylla Merian. Merian. M-E-R-I-A-N. How would you pronounce that?
Merian. Merian.
I'm leaning towards Merian. 1647 to 1717. She was a naturalist and science illustrator in the late 16 and early 1700s who revolutionized botany and zoology with her detailed observations and drawings of insects, plants, and animals. Now, Merian published many books and collections of beautiful natural engravings. I really look her up. And when you see them, you're like, yeah, those are like iconic scientific illustrations. They were engravings, illustrations, paintings, and they made her famous, particularly for her drawings and meticulous observations of a butterfly metamorphosis. David Attenborough himself said that she was among the most significant contributors to the field of entomology. Her work was especially revolutionary considering the scientific attitude towards insects at that time. This was a little bit of a surprise. They were pretty much considered by everyone, especially scientists, as vile and disgusting, or even beasts of the devil.
Lord of the Flies.
Yes, right. That also means that no one really cared to learn much about them, including the amazing process of a metamorphosis, which was known about. I mean, they knew that that happened, but not many people understood it at all. So her findings taught scientists a great deal about that process. And of course, even the most rudimentary and critical facts, such as that they weren't created in rotting mud by spontaneous generation. I mean, that was not a rare belief at that time. Remember, we're talking late 1600s. She was also among the first scientists to study insects as they lived, unlike most scientists at that time who used preserved specimens, which, of course, as you can imagine, is quite limiting. And, of course, that would also give her insight into things that you just couldn't get any other way, things about their habitats, their habits, and even how the local populations used the insects when she went traveling. Still, her findings were pretty much ignored by the scientific community for a little while. Except the German High Society. They were just eating that stuff up. And that's mainly because she wrote in the vernacular. She wrote in German, but she did not write in the language of science at that time, which of course was Latin. So that's the main reason why I think that she was kind of dismissed. In 1699, she was awarded a grant for a scientific expedition to South America to study the plants and animals, which may have been possibly the first such trip planned that was explicitly and only for science. There's a little bit of confusion if she was the first, but I think it's fairly clear that she was at the very least the first European woman to do such a thing. Very interesting, beautiful artwork. Check her out, see what she's done. And so remember Maria Sibylla Merian. Mention her to your friends, perhaps after you put huge fake insects in their beds or cars to scare the shit out of them.
What, with Halloween coming?
Yep.
And all.
So that was one of the acceptable vocations for a woman,
yes,
that time.
Illustrations,
okay for them to do something artsy like illustrate, and it was okay for them to study things like butterflies and flowers. So that was one of the acceptable science pathways for a woman at that time. But she made the most of it. So, have you guys heard this has been buzzing around social media that placebos are getting stronger?
Yeah.
You heard about that?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's stupid.
Think about that statement. It
it sounds
it's quite a claim.
Counterintuitive, but it's actually true.
Steve, doesn't that mean that people are getting dumber?
Well, that's actually the $64,000 question. Not that exactly, but is it something to do with changing people or whatever, or techniques or whatever? But let me tell you what's going on. So this is an actual study. They looked at 23 years of clinical trials looking at pain medication used to treat neuropathic pain. So just one type of indication to keep it as homogeneous as possible. And they found that the size of the response in the placebo arm of studies looking at these drugs for neuropathic pain has been increasing over the last 23 years, narrowing the difference between the placebo response and the medication response, and thereby obscuring a real response from the medication itself. Does that make sense? The real response, you could imagine, is actually increasing a little bit, but the placebo response is increasing more, and so that gap is narrowing. So statistically, it's harder to separate the two. That's the data. I mean, I think that's not controversial. That's been happening. Interestingly, that's only been happening in the U.S. It is not happening in European studies over the same time period.
Hmm.
So okay. The big question is really, why is this happening? And there are two types of explanations. One is sort of in line with what Jay said, not that people are getting dumber, but that people are just getting more susceptible to placebo responses. You know, then that, of course, then leads to the question, well, why is that? Lots of speculation, no data, no evidence about why that might be, but some people are speculating, including the authors and other scientists, saying, well, maybe because of drug direct-to-consumer advertising, that people have higher expectations for what drugs can do for them. Maybe just the culture itself is more amenable to these kinds of effects. And so, you know, again, people are just psychologically having a larger expectation effect from the placebo treatment. I don't know. I don't really buy that myself. I think that it probably has more to do with how we're carrying out clinical trials. So the other possibility is that it's the way studies are being designed and executed that's increasing the placebo effect. So remember, placebo effects are multiple. It's not one placebo effect. It's not just all expectation or mind over matter. There's a lot of illusory artifacts, regression to the mean and reporting bias, etc. So there's a lot of things that make up that measured effect in the placebo arm of a clinical trial. And so there's lots of opportunities for there to be things that will affect the placebo effect. So here's a couple of interesting things. The motivation to recruit patients as subjects into clinical trial is always there. And pharmaceutical companies have been wanting to do bigger trials, thinking that if they can get more and more subjects into a clinical trial, they'll be able to statistically separate, you know, the drug effect from the placebo effect better, which makes sense. And so with increasing pressure to recruit, one of the things that might happen is that the centers, which may even be a private company who's getting paid per recruit, that they might, you know, fudge the entry criteria a little bit. Like, if you exaggerate how bad the patient is to get them over the line so that they meet the inclusion criteria, then once they're in the study, of course, that exaggeration goes away and they regress to the mean and to their real baseline. And that looks like an improvement. So that's one possibility. Just increased motivation to recruit subjects could be leading to that effect. It's also possible that just patients are being treated better in clinical trials. They're being taken care of better. We're getting better at doing the trials in that way. And so the whole experience of being a subject in a clinical trial is better than it was 23 years ago. And that leads to a greater placebo effect. Just the non-specific benefits of being in a clinical trial. Yeah. So, something like that's happening, it seems. Again, this data doesn't answer the question. It just says there is this growing placebo effect. But it's actually a real problem. Well, it could be a problem. Actually, let me say that, because the other question is the increasing placebo effect and the narrowing gap between placebos and drugs, does that reflect clinical trials getting better or getting worse? In other words, are we seeing an increasing false negative or a decreasing false positive over time? So are we just getting better at doing more accurate clinical trials, and therefore the false positives of 20 years ago are getting erased by better study techniques? Or are the factors that I mentioned leading to just this obscuring placebo effect, which is causing false negatives because it's harder to separate out the drug effect statistically?
Well, it sounds like, are you leaning towards the latter?
I think we don't know the answer to that question. And it could be both of those things could be happening. Mm. So, of course, pharmaceutical companies are aware of this. They were aware of this before this study was published, that there's a problem with it's getting harder for whatever reason to separate out drug effects from placebo effects. One of the things that they've done is called a lead-in study. So they give everybody, they don't tell everybody that they're doing this. They have all the subjects in the clinical trial. They give everybody a placebo. And then after like 3 weeks or some lead-in period, they say, all right, who has reported a significant placebo response to the treatment? Then they basically don't count them in the trial. Then they randomize the non-responders to placebo or treatment. So you're essentially factoring out the placebo responders in the first phase of the study and then only studying the non-responders, which sounds like it should have a really positive impact on minimizing the placebo response or the, you know, the measured placebo response in the group. But it actually has the results are mixed. It doesn't always work, which is really interesting. Which also suggests that the lot of the placebo effect is just random noise, you know? It's not really the people so much as just the process of doing the study itself.
Does doing it that way affect the study?
It's an interesting question. Is it biasing the study in some way? It statistically, no. But you wonder, though. I've always wondered. I haven't been able to put my finger on it, but it seems like there's a possibility. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody figured out that, this is biasing these studies in some way.
Interesting.
But I can't think of it in any specific way that it would do that, you know, because you're randomizing afterwards. If you were randomizing ahead of time, then that would be problematic. Mm-hmm. But you're still taking a group of people, randomizing them, and seeing what happens to them. How you selected them doesn't really matter if it's pre-randomization. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So statistically, it seems legitimate to me. So anyway, we may need to think about tweaking things a little bit to reverse this trend, but we still don't know what it means. And so it's hard to know whether we should or how to fix it. One thing when I wrote about this in Science-Based Medicine, I commented that what's interesting, if you think about it, how hard it is to tease apart real effects from placebo effects, even when you're doing a carefully controlled clinical trial. Imagine how impossible it is to tease those things apart with just anecdotal evidence. You know, you can't. It's just overwhelmed with placebo effects. You can't separate them out.
And that's how and why it's so hard, I think, to change people's minds with data, especially if that anecdote is their own. And so it's got an emotional valence on it. I felt that. I got better. Or this one's so common. I got the flu after I got a flu shot. No, you didn't.
Yeah.
You may have. There's a slight risk that you did, but more than likely you had some sort of immune reaction that kind of felt like the flu for a day. But
or you got a cold.
Or you got a cold, like, which is also very common. But this is one that I hear all the time.
People's own anecdotes trump the scientific data. That emotionally, that's the case. It's hard to get people over that threshold where they will dismiss their own experience because it conflicts with, you know, with hard and fast scientific data, it's interesting. All right, Kara.
Yes.
This is an interesting item. I found this to be a fairly complicated item.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to tell us about the hubbub surrounding the, is it a Danish zoo?
It is.
And some of their recent cullings that they've done.
Yes, Steve. There is a Danish zoo called the Odense Zoo. It's in central Denmark. And it is under fire right now, specifically for having dissected a lion in front of zoo-goers last Thursday. There were about 300 to 400 children in the audience. And I'll tell you that the internet was outraged. The zoo-goers weren't very outraged, but the internet sure was. Even John Oliver launched a scathing comedic takedown of the dissection. And he actually said this on air. I watched this, which is what prompted me to want to do this story. He said, quote, "It's like you told them there's no Santa or that there is, but he's dead and this is his spleen." Which, okay,
line.
It's funny. It's funny. But I will say as an aside, John Oliver has taken issues with zoos before, so it's unsurprising that he would cover this story in this way. The overall conversation, and I think that this is where things can get complicated, about the history and the current role that zoos hold is a very interesting one. And I think there's a lot of interesting things that are up for debate, but we'll shelf that for now so that we can continue specifically on this story. I don't want to get caught in the weeds, but I do want everybody to remember that just last year, another Danish zoo, actually the Copenhagen Zoo, triggered massive backlash for killing a healthy young giraffe and feeding it to a lion in front of ongoers. But this is the rub, isn't it? It's because I use the word healthy. And this is what the media did quite a lot around this story. Yes, the young giraffe was healthy, but the young giraffe was also inbred, which meant that he was of no use to the zoos because he couldn't be introduced into any of their mating programs. And this is the same reason that this young lion was culled. It was cold actually 9 months ago, and it has been in the freeze since then. It was at risk of inbreeding because this young lion was in an enclosure within a pride where the only suitable mates would have been members of her genetic line and of her family line, and that wouldn't have been safe for her offspring. And if you think about it, there are almost worse kind of downstream effects. If she did have a baby, that baby would need to be culled, and that can cause like profound psychological damage on the mothers who do give birth and then have their children taken away.
Hey, Kara, I recently read an article, not too recently, but I read one describing these breeding programs. It's not a simple thing. Oh, all these animals go forth, have sex. This is a meticulous program. All different zoos communicate with each other about the different types of, say, whatever giraffes that they have. And it's a really thoughtful process to determine what to do with their breeding stock and to make sure that they're very diverse. So this is
You're so right. And it's not just in Denmark. This is a European group.
Specifically European-wide.
Europe does this very differently than we do in the States, which is partially to blame, I think, for the outcry. But yes, Europe-wide, you're right. They keep meticulous records and medical records so that they can figure out what the breeding stocks are and so that they don't mix. And this is the reason, if you remember back to that baby giraffe that was culled and then fed to the lions, it wasn't really that young. And the reason they culled it after it was a little bit older was because they needed it to be able to wean with mom so that the mother giraffe that was going to continue to live her life wouldn't have terrible psychological ramifications from having her infant child taken away and culled. So that is, just remember that story as you're thinking about this story. So this lion was at risk of inbreeding. And don't get me wrong, these Danish officials worked very, very hard to try and get her into another zoo. You know, they looked at the paperwork, they sent out calls to pretty much every other zoo in this European consortium, and nobody would take her. So this was kind of a last ditch solution, was to go ahead and euthanize her.
Did they explain all that before it actually took place?
Yes.
That sort of the public would be aware of exactly
of
what's
course,
going on?
Of course, but whose responsibility is it really to inform themselves? If this is all listed on a website or in a press release, is it likely that every journalist is going to read that? It should be. Do they?
Gosh, no.
Of course not.
Yeah.
So leading back to the dissection of itself, of course, outrage ensued when it was announced that the dissection would take place. Not when the lion was culled 9 months ago, by the way. Lion's been in the deep freeze for 9 months. They take the lion out. They say, we're going to dissect this lion. It's a break from school, so all these school children will be able to be there. And of course, the Danish mothers and fathers are like, cool, this is a great learning experience. And over on this side of the pond, we're freaking out about this. Here's a quote from zookeeper Michael Wahlberg Sorensen. He said, quote, we are not chopping up animals for fun. We believe in sharing knowledge. Let's see. The purpose of the public dissection is to give people a closer to the animal's experience, and it is important not to give animals human attributes that they do not have.
Ah.
I'm going to paraphrase here, but a lot of the parents and the kids were covering their mouths and noses because it smelled very bad. And to paraphrase the zookeeper, he said something publicly during the dissection. Would it not be stranger if this animal smelled like flowers? A dead animal smells like a dead animal. There's not much we can do about that. And I just love this kind of frank approach that they have specifically in these Danish zoos, but it seems like more commonly in these European zoos. This is a learning experience. Let's learn why we're doing it. Let's, instead of having this animal go to waste, let's open it up. Let's show children what it looks like on the inside. And then I think that they can respect the creature that much more. There's a quote that I see a lot, or kind of a sensibility that I'm seeing across some of the articles that take a more positive stance on this, that the world is not a Disney movie and probably we should stop pretending like it is.
Yeah.
So that's my take. I mean, if I were to give you my opinion, which of course is informed by the science, I think that this is a great model. I think it's something that is very cool that it's happening. I would love to have been a child who could attend a zoo dissection.
Yeah, that was all voluntary, right? It's not like
it's all voluntary.
Forced to be there.
Yeah. Exactly. That too is completely voluntary. And so I just think it's a really cool program that they do. And also, this zoo does it twice a year. So I'm not sure why everybody's freaking out about this one time. I think we see it with giraffes, we see it with zebras, we see it with lions because they're cute.
They're a charismatic megafauna. That's how they're characterized.
There you go. AKA cute.
It comes on the heels of that dentist who shot the lion in Africa not too long ago. And the totally it's different, absolutely.
Lured,
but the emotional outrage.
Out of a protected area and killed it.
I
completely agree, Evan. People are referencing that in a lot of these articles because they are conflating these two issues.
I did a lot of background research on this as well because I really wanted to wrap my head around it because, like you, Kara, I had this profound sense that the internet was wrong. You know, that basically this superficial outrage was somehow missing the point. And I wanted to know, at least, what do they say to defend themselves? So there's a few other facts I want to add here. One is that culling of animals is in Europe, this is a standard procedure.
Yep.
It's an intrinsic part of their breeding program. They are managing these populations. The breeding programs are very successful. Part of that success is that they end up with too many animals, more than they have the money, space, resources to care for. And then they make decisions about which animals are genetically the most valuable. And those that are essentially genetically worthless, they would never breed them, nor would they want to breed them for the genetic health of the population. Sometimes they cull them. Now, throughout Europe, thousands of animals are culled a year.
And this is for the health of the species, not the individual animal.
Exactly. Now, although, of course, sometimes they will cull animals that are sick.
Sure.
They will cull, if there's two sick animals and they only have the resources to treat one, they'll pick the one that's genetically valuable and cull the other one. So it's all part of an interconnected program to optimize these zoo populations. They do trade with other zoos as well. But they do use culling. Now, the thousands of animals is a little bit misleading because most of them are rats and mice and small animals. But there's probably hundreds of larger animals that people would care about on Twitter, you know, zebras and hippos and lions and bears and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that those animals are a little bit less common and it may be more newsworthy when they do get culled, but it does happen.
This is random. I mean, that same zoo, the Copenhagen Zoo, culled four lions a year ago, two lionesses and two cubs because they were bringing in a new male. The male would have killed the cubs, you know, and they wanted to make sure that there was no inbreeding happening. They wanted to keep the way clear for the new male they were bringing in. It's just all part of the program.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing you could say is that in the United States, we also have breeding programs, but we don't use culling. We use birth control to limit the populations. So, that's, I think, the only real legitimate criticism here. These European zoos are following the European model. It's all legal. It's all ethical by their own internal standards. The only thing we could say is, well, in the United States, our zoos have managed to do the same thing without culling by using birth control. And so maybe European zoos under public pressure will switch over to the American model.
And
that's, I think, reasonable.
I don't think they will, because I think that you see a lot of backlash of that model saying that this is not healthy for the natural menstrual cycles of the animals. It's not healthy for their physiology and their biology to be putting them on contraceptives.
Yeah, it's all a trade-off. It's all a trade-off. But again, what they are doing... Yeah, but reading the comments, though, was so disappointing, just like always, you know, reading comments on social media. It's like people just don't get it. It's like, oh, these people are awful killing animals. Like, you know, think about it for a minute. You know, these are people whose lives are dedicated to taking care of animals. They're doing this for a reason. But I do think it is sort of the Disney. It's like, it's Mustafa.
Yeah,
you know,
it is. It's so comes down to that. And
I
think
that
there's also kind of a fluffy worldview of like zoos themselves are morally bankrupt. The idea of the zoo as an institution is something that should be done away with. And of course, this goes back many years because zoos did start, they were indistinguishable from circuses at the beginning.
Yeah.
They did start more as an entertainment venture, but most legitimate zoos now, especially those that are backed by, governmental or educational foundations, really do it as a conservation and an educational effort. They're critical. If we didn't have zoos, many species that are extinct in the wild would no longer exist. They just wouldn't. It's a way that we can conserve species. And that's what they're doing with these megafauna and with these smaller animals.
Yeah.
They're absolutely conserving the species, and they're conserving them in the healthiest way possible. And I don't know. This is one of those things where I kind of feel like, you know what? You may be an animal rights activist. You may be, you know, a tree hugger, whatever you want to call yourself. But at a certain point, maybe we should read the data. Maybe we should listen to the experts and see why they're doing what they're doing. Because yes, you're right, Steve. Let's personify these people. Yeah, let's have a real conversation. And let's personify these people that are doing the culling. These people are probably crying over losing certain animals that they've bonded with. Like, yes, these are the people, yeah, that are the closest to the animals, and they're making that decision. Probably better than, you know, you from your couch.
One more statistic to put things into perspective, because I think perspective is what we're going for here. Mm-hmm. So the United States, we don't cull zoo animals, but we euthanize 2.7 million dogs and cats a year in shelters. 2.7 million.
Whoa.
Wow.
Compared to the thousands that, yeah, are that in zoos that are being culled, most of which are rats and mice. So anyway, sometimes, you know, you have no choice. You have to euthanize animals.
Mm-hmm. True. I tell you, though, the most unexpected disappointment in all this was that John Oliver missed the nuance of all this.
I agree. I was so bummed out because he's such a skeptic usually.
John, I still love you, and we're going to get you on this show.
Okay. You're still welcome.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And, you know, if there was an argument to be had about his frustration with zoos, I think that that's an interesting argument. But you're right. This idea that what this Danish zoo was doing was somehow morally bankrupt is just completely missing all of the nuance.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. All right, Evan, this is a fun one. So, I like this. I like conspiracy theories. So, it's been a little bit of an update on, of all things, the JFK conspiracy theory.
Ah, yes, the story that will never go away, I don't think. This is ingrained in our culture. JFK assassination. Was it a conspiracy? Who knows?
No.
Let's see what the science says. So, on the cover of the February 1964 issue of Life magazine, there is this famous photo of Lee Harvey Oswald, who is the man who assassinated John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, in November of 1963. Practically since the release of that photo, there's been a huge debate as to whether or not the photo was genuine or fake. So a little bit of background. After police had arrested Lee Harvey Oswald on suspicion of assassinating President Kennedy, they searched his home and found a picture of him standing in his backyard. In one hand, he held a rifle, and in the other hand were copies of two communist newspapers, The Militant and The Worker. His wife, Marina, said she had taken the photo in the spring of 1963. And the photo was considered highly incriminating because the rifle in the photo was the one, appears to be the one that he used to actually shoot Kennedy. For the multitude of people who still to this day believe that John Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy and not a single assassin, they often point to this very picture as part of the larger web of deceit that's being perpetrated on us all to this day. A recent Gallup poll shows that 61% of people believe that there were multiple people involved in the assassination or other people, while 30% believe that Oswald acted alone. And back in 2000, those numbers were 81% and 13% respectively.
Wow.
So the numbers may fluctuate through history, but still the majority of people believe that this was a conspiracy on some level. There's news this week. Researchers at Dartmouth College have published a computer analysis of the photo in order to try to determine if some of the claims of the conspiracy theorists who believe that the photo is fake to figure out if it really is fake or if it's genuine. Specifically, the study they did addresses the claims that Oswald is standing at a peculiar angle, a physically implausible angle, if you will, and that the shadows being cast in the photo are inconsistent.
Yeah, because if you could definitively prove that that photo was faked, you have a conspiracy because somebody faked the photo.
Right. Somebody else.
That would
else
be like
is in
the first positive evidence of an actual conspiracy. So,
what the researchers at Dartmouth College did is they created a 3D reconstruction of the image using software called Blender. And they created Oswald's skeleton, his skin. They distributed his weight throughout the body, and they exactly duplicated his stance, and then they calculated his center of gravity. They concluded that his center of gravity lies well within his base of support, so his stance was stable.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it using about a million different sort of little adjustments, yeah. basically, to the analysis. And 99.99% of the time, the reconstructions were deemed stable.
So it was very stable, if you account for any possible wiggle room for how they reconstructed the image. He's stable.
Very stable. And I'd say, you know, going over it a million times is a pretty good data set. And also, while they were doing this reconstruction of the photo, they also demonstrated that the shadows in the picture are consistent. They reconstructed the lighting and the camera angle, and there you have it. The shadows that appear in the photo were the same ones reproduced in the 3D reconstruction.
Yep. It was wonderful overkill, you know, but it's nice to have solid evidence. But also the researchers said that they, you know, invested in developing this process, which then can be used on any photo. So
I thought,
it serves a generic purpose, and they just applied it to this photo as a first go. So that's good. They used their time and effort to develop a technology. But you have to like read articles or watch the videos of the people claiming that the photo was faked. It's a wonderful documentation of the process of anomaly hunting, which is the bread and butter of conspiracy theorists. They look at the photo and they just find anything about it that they could hype into an anomaly, like his stance. Oh, look, his stance is at it. And then they draw lines and go, look, it's his center of gravity is outside of his feet, so it wouldn't be stable. But they're just totally shooting from the hip. They're complete cranks. You know, they're doing crank science where superficially looks like they're doing something somewhat scientific. But if you have any sense how science actually operates, when you read it, you're like, this just sounds like a bunch of bullshit. Like they're just making stuff up as they go along, you know?
And that's the calling card of the conspiracy theorist, Steve, is that they start with a conclusion and they work backwards, cherry picking data and drawing lines and points to support their argument. They're not taking it from the approach, well, let's look at this from a clean perspective and then come up with a conclusion. They go totally backwards with it.
But listen, the anomaly hunting is funny. I mean, just look it up. Look up the Oswald backyard photo fake and you'll find these videos very, very quickly. And they make so many different claims, and it's just looking at a low res picture and look, this smudge on his chin means that his head was cropped on there. No, it doesn't. It's a freaking smudge. You know, it's whatever.
It's a smudge. It's a water stain, technically, is what it is.
And then it's like, look how much the shadow moves. And Marina said that she took these pictures right after each other. Well, okay, well, she was wrong. You know, it was 10 minutes later, you know, whatever. You know, but that's, again, they're just looking for anomalies. And then they declare that evidence of whatever, you know, they want it to be evidence of. But then you read this study, like, yeah, this is real science. And that, you know, you could really see the difference between, you know, proceeding carefully and scientifically and just making crap up as you go along. All right. Well, Bob, you haven't given us a quickie in a while.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
And it just so happens that I am prepared. So thank you, Steve. This is your quickie with Bob. And a new MIT strategic engineering study has concluded that the most cost and fuel effective manned trip to Mars includes a stopover near the moon to pick up fuel created and then launched from the moon. Interesting idea. So their calculations show that this could reduce the initial launch mass from Earth by 68%. I was just amazed at the size of that. 68% is massive. So this could be a huge improvement over current plans, even if you add the launch mass costs from the moon and added that to the launches from the Earth. So it could still be a huge improvement. And if you go over and if you make calculations for what some of these launches to Mars would cost, this could potentially save $5.8 billion per Mars mission. Nice. Which is just a staggering amount. And just think, those savings alone could go a long way for all the research and development that would be needed to create the kind of infrastructure that you would need to actually do this. You know, you would need a method to gather the regolith or whatever you would need to create to fuel, to process it, to launch it, all that kind of stuff. So the numbers in this study, of course, assumes that this required infrastructure to do this already exists. So they made that assumption, already exists on the moon. So even though this idea, therefore, is not necessarily for the first time we go to Mars or a one-time trip, but if you have, if you plan on making routine, recurring Mars trips, then a plan like this makes that much, much more realistic. If that infrastructure was in place. So this has been your Quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, we need to develop the Earth-Moon infrastructure before we go to Mars.
Right.
I still think that's the right idea.
Yeah, and one big surprise to me, one of the first thoughts I had is, well, what if we build a nuclear thermal rocket? Then that would be much more efficient than chemical fuel. Would we still need it? Would we still need a plan like this where you'd create, you know, a depot, a fuel depot, and possibly one of the Earth-Moon Lagrange points, which is what I was talking about. And it turns out that you would still need this kind of setup to make it as efficient as possible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think they should definitely consider this, because that just – these savings, billions of dollars per launch to Mars, that's just amazing.
Yep. All right, guys. So we're going to talk briefly about Back to the Future Day. So in the movies Back to the Future, in the first movie, Marty McFly goes back in time to 1955, and then the professor has to get him back to the future, to his time, 1985. Then in the second movie, he goes into the future and arrives on October 21st, 2015, which is
today.
There
he is now.
Yeah.
Wow.
So now, obviously, this, I don't think that they were trying to, they were going for an accurate presentation of the future. They were just filling it with cliches, right? Yeah. Futurism cliches.
Sure.
But still, it's kind of fun to see what those cliches are and how that, you know, comports with reality. So I actually just rewatched the movie today. To remind myself of it. There's a lot of things. So they really pack in the futurism there. So in the 2015 of Back to the Future, they have weather control. You remember that?
Mm-hmm. What? Yep.
They have the weather service controls the weather.
Yep. That is whack. I totally forget that. Wow.
You have hover cars, obviously. Hover everything. They basically just have anti-gravity.
Everything.
Hoverboards, hover cars, right. There's things floating in the air. So clearly they invented anti-grav. At some point, the inflation was out of control. It was like $50 for a Pepsi, if you remember, which was crazy. apparently, with video games, you don't have to use your hands anymore. They don't exactly explain that. But, you know, remember, the kids are talking about the old video games, like you have to use your hands. That's a child's game.
That's for babies.
They had the big holographic board that showed that preview of Jaws.
Yeah.
Jaws 19.
Jaws 19, yeah.
Mercifully, they stopped it.
The flat screen TVs were pretty good. You know, the multiple channels, mm-hmm. you know, was not how it's done typically.
TV glasses.
They had like Google Glass type thing there. Yeah. That was in bed. But a lot of embedded technology. So, like, they were talking to everything, you know. Everything was essentially AI interface. Like Siri, but in everything. You know, they were talking to the TV and talking to the, you know, ordering their lunch or whatever.
We're more on the cusp of that.
Yeah, that one wasn't crazy, crazy. We actually could do that now, I think. It's basically Siri, just embedded in more places.
Yep. We did not get the self-tying sneakers.
No, those exist.
Yeah, those, I think those exist.
You can, like, make them yourself with a little servo.
You need a little motor in the shoe. I've never seen it, though. Did you see a video of it?
But Nike's not mass producing them, though.
No, Nike's not mass producing them, but you can look it up online. There's, like, just Google, like, how to make self-lacing shoes, Back to the Future. And there's, like, a whole video about how to do it yourself with a little servo.
But they still have faxes.
Yeah, that was kind of whack. Like that's, you know, because they obviously missed the whole idea of email and texting, and they were thinking, faxing. That was a big one too. And faxing, they just kind of like made these super faxes, I guess. But so that was kind of out. But also kind of related to that, they actually not related at all. But if in one quick scene, you saw these big pallets of laser discs, which I think were getting kind of big at that point, but they totally did not pan out. They were such a tiny little kind of intermediary technology.
Laser discs. Wow.
Another hover, big one.
What? Hoverboards.
Well, yeah, they had hover everything. But the other big one was Mr. Fusion.
You like Mr. Fusion?
And not only portable, like, fusion technology for your car, but he, like, put in banana peels in a tin can, you know.
Oh, that's right.
Any aluminum garbage, can, yeah. Rather, yeah. That would have been a more realistic extrapolation, maybe 100 years in the future, you know, not 30 years.
Yeah, true.
And even then, I still don't think we're going to have hover cars. But you guys remember watching that movie in 1985 or whatever it was?
Yeah, of course.
I did not watch that movie in 1985.
First of all, 30 years seems like forever in the future. That's like thinking about, like, what's it going to be like in 2045?
Oh, my God.
It seems really far in the future, but it's really not that far.
Will we have hover cars in 2045?
Well, no. We have hoverboards now. They're not, mass-produced. I rode one.
But no way.
You have to be on metal.
You got to be on metal, right? You got to be on a special surface.
Yeah,
is there
a
video of that?
Yeah, there's video. I rode a Hendo hoverboard, and it was freaking awesome. It's really hard to do, though.
I could imagine.
Really, because you don't, you know, when you're skateboarding, the wheels go in a certain direction, so you can push, and you go in one direction. When you're on a hoverboard, there's no directionality to it at all, so you just float around.
Yeah, you just use force.
It's very hard to do. But one of the kids at the Hendo place who was doing a demo could like skate the half pipe on it. It was badass.
Wow.
Cool. Yeah,
but Steve, you're right. 30 years seems like a long time, but it's really not, kind of. But I think if you look forward to, say, you know, to 2040 or so, I think we're kind of approaching the point where by the time that year comes, I think we're going to see some.
Don't embarrass yourself, Bob.
Bob, you're going to come 2040. You might regret this.
No, I think fine. I don't think I will, but I think, and I'm not going to make specific predictions. I'm going to say that I think by 2040, we're going to see some technologies that are really disruptive, like changing the game. You want to give me crap in 2040? Go right ahead. I think you're right about that.
I think they were worried you were going to go the other direction with that. I think there'll be some majorly disruptive, but you
absolutely.
Know how you always hear people going like, we've got everything we have. Mm-hmm. There's not going to be many more.
Everything's
pretty much awesome now.
We plateaued.
Yeah, exactly. No, everybody says that. But no, okay. We're going to be storing data on microscopic cellular sized places. Like the sky's the limit when we can get data storage smaller and smaller. It's going to be freaking awesome.
I still think that your sensibilities are premature. Like what you think we're going to have in 30 years, we're really going to have in 60 years.
That's why I'm not making anything specific. I'm saying what I'm predicting is some surprisingly disruptive technologies. That's what I'm saying.
If we're going to talk about Back to the Future, we have to talk about the video that claims that Back to the Future 2 predicted 9/11.
You guys haven't seen this?
Come on.
No.
What?
Was that part of the notes?
I thought you guys knew this.
This is going to be our
dumbest thing of the week.
All on you.
Cool. All right.
So you got to watch this video. Just type in Back to the Future predicts 9/11. And again, it's just all coincidence hunting. So it's like, oh, look, Marty goes to the Twin Pine Malls where there's a terrorist attack. And then when he comes back, it's the Lone Pine. That's the Twin Pines or the Twin Towers. And then they get replaced by one tower. Yeah, the Freedom One Tower.
Oh my God.
There you go. And then it's like, it's 116, which if you turn that upside down, that spells 9/11. And then of course, in the next scene, it's 119.
It does.
Which is not upside down. It's flipped. And then the great one is like, there's, when Marty comes back, remember when he comes back to the future and he leaves the flaming trail?
Yes.
So the flaming trail is the 11, and there's a neon, like one of the neon signs on the street kind of makes a 9. So you have the neon sign is 9, and then the two fire trails are 11. So it's like all that kind of stuff.
You can't argue with
this. And then here's when they're in the future, they're watching, you know, on the TV in the, you know, the older Marty's house, there are random scenes popping up. And one of the images that pops up is of the Twin Towers. The screen flickers so that the image scrolls up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the towers are scrolling up off of the TV monitor. Now, remember that Marty McFly's father had back problems and was floating upside down. Hover traction. So from his perspective,
oh my God,
the towers were falling down.
Wow. Oh my gosh, it's true.
The guy who did the video doesn't think that the producers of the movie knew about 9/11, whatever, almost 30 years before.
It was a psychic premonition. They didn't even
know. The universe was speaking to us through this movie. The universe knew.
If only we listened.
Universe,
we could have prevented this.
That's right. And that's what the whole movie is about preventing something awful from happening in the future because you know about it and we didn't listen.
What a joke.
Oh, we are.
There you go.
I we can't are even, stupid monkeys.
I can't believe that people spend their precious time on this stuff.
So, but is this a YouTube video?
Yeah.
How many hits does it have?
905,000.
Oh, my God.
Maybe this guy's a little smarter than we thought.
Yeah, we need 6,000 more.
Yeah.
Let's move on. All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
All right. Last week, I played this noisy. What is it?
It sounds like
another blaster.
It sounds like the probe that came down that blew up
on the Hoth system when they shot the probe.
No, I don't think not that's even it. Close.
Not even close.
No. I don't recognize it.
You will when I tell you.
Okay.
That is the Predator's shoulder-mounted.
Is it really
the plasma gun? Right.
It sounds so rinky-dink when you just cut it out separately.
I know. It's not contextually. It's just by itself, and you don't really feel it. Listener Jim Butts correctly guessed it. So, Jim, good job. And I played another noisy, guys, if you remember. It went something like this.
Wow, that was intense.
What was that? Yeah, what was that?
Vacuum.
Some kind of cutting tool.
I don't know. It sounded like a disaster. Like somebody was screaming in the background.
Well, I'll tell you what. This is a part, hopefully, a big part of our future.
Oh.
Those are fusing atoms, and they make a very loud and eerie scream-like sound when fusion takes place. Yep.
What?
So you're hearing a test plasma fusion reactor called the Alcator C-Mod, and that's located at MIT's Plasma Science and Fusion Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts, United States. So that is fusion taking place.
Cool.
And that's the noise that it makes.
I should have recognized that.
I think that is amazing. That is absolutely amazing.
Amazing that they got to record that. Yeah.
So a listener named Ian Blackstone sent that one to me. Thank you, Ian. That was really awesome. I loved reading about that, and I watched the video several times. It just makes you question, like, that's, you know, 2 seconds of fusion happening. What will it sound like when it's on a massive scale happening consistently? You know,
well,
we can't do this, you know, for thousands of hours at a time yet.
They just put some like sort of sound damper on it.
Wait a second. I mean, these were sounds that they simulated. I mean, right? That they
can very temporarily make, they can isolate the plasma and do it. They can actually do fusion for, you know, seconds. That's it.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like. So Jeremy Moss actually guessed the sound this week. Very good, Jeremy. And I found an email as I was going through my Who's That Noisy emails. I found a very funny email. This was one, the guy's responding to episode 535 a few episodes ago. And he said, the Who's That Noisy on episode 535 is obviously the sound of virginity that results from knowing what that sound is. He calls it the celibacy blaster.
I love it.
Awesome.
So on that note, this was the last week for Blaster Sounds. I wanted to thank everybody. It was a lot of fun. But, you know, I want to move on to other things, hopefully Star Wars related.
Right, like engines.
Doesn't necessarily mean that you won't get a random here and again. So, guys, email me the answer to this one. Email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Tell me what you guess. Send me in some noisies that you find that you love, and good luck, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thank you, Jay. So we have one email question this week, although I'm not going to read a specific email because we had a few emails. I'm just going to give you the gist of what they said. So if you recall, last week we had George Robb on the show, and he was talking about the fact that the singer of his band, the Philadelphia Funk Authority, Alyssa Anderson, died recently of cancer. She had been sick for a while, of course, and she was in hospice, and she did finally succumb. And of course, it's very sad because she was young. She was only like 50, which, by the way, is young. Cool. Is young officially. This led to a discussion about what happens when somebody close to an atheist dies.
Yeah.
Specifically, We talked about the fact that it's very common for religious people in your life to say, to offer religious-based condolences, like they're in heaven now, they're with God, they're singing with the angels, etc. And George was, you know, asking, and we were talking about, like, how we respond to that. Few people emailed taking exception to our discussion, saying that we were essentially being mean or dismissive to people of faith. But I do not agree with that interpretation. I want to discuss where we were coming from with that discussion very briefly. So basically, we had two points to make. The first point was when you are consoling somebody for a massive loss, like the death of a loved one, be a little thoughtful about their cultural background. I think people just thoughtlessly will assume that everyone shares their basic worldview, their faith, their religion, and that's not a good assumption to make in a pluralistic society, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So the example I gave was, imagine if you had a Jewish friend or acquaintance or colleague or whatever who lost a loved one and you're a Christian. Would you say to them as a way of consoling them, well, they're with Jesus now? Now, of course you wouldn't say that. If you did say that, I think it would be right to characterize that as either thoughtless or misguided. And the Jewish person, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Evan, would probably not have the response that you were going for. You know, if you told them that their dead loved one is with Jesus, when right. clearly that's not part of their faith, their religion.
Nope.
Yeah. So just our advice was don't do that because, you know, that's just not either that's thoughtless or even worse. Right. If you think, well, it doesn't matter. I don't care because I'm expressing my faith. So I was very clear about the fact. I said, now, if two people share a faith and you know that this person shares your faith, fine. You obviously can console each other within the context of your faith. I have no problem with that. It was that I think people of faith don't realize how culturally insensitive it can be to non-believers to be told things like your loved one is now in heaven or with God, things we don't believe in. That's not comforting to us.
Again, kind of it's not just that it's not comforting. It's like off-putting.
It's off-putting.
I mean, it's different to say my thoughts and prayers are with you. You know, good. You can pray for me. That's fine. That's your prerogative.
I agree. I have no problem with that. That's a statement about what they're doing or how they feel, as opposed to saying something about reality, like your loved one is now with my God that you don't believe in. It's insulting, actually.
Yeah.
It's like your worldview doesn't even matter. I don't have to take it into consideration. I'm going to trample on it in the guise of consoling you. So I also think that most people wouldn't want that to be the result. I mean, I think they mean well. We even said this. Listen, we don't get angry people. We give them a pass because we know it's people are – they mean well and they're just trying to do their best in a time of great loss. But if you care about the effect of your condolences, be thoughtful about who you're talking to. Don't assume they share your faith. You could certainly say something if you're not sure – what their faith is. Don't assume that you know. You could say something that's faith neutral, like my thoughts are with you, even my prayers are with you is fine because that's just a statement about yourself or whatever, just something like that. You don't have to say they're with God or they're with Jesus or they're with the angels or whatever.
I would love to interject just because I wasn't there for this conversation last week, how sad that is for George. And also, it reminds me of something that happened quite recently in my life where a dear friend of mine lost his little sister. And I didn't know her and didn't attend the services, but he reached out to me to tell me that she had passed away and asked me if I knew of any humanist pastors because she was an atheist. And he had been really struggling with his parents to try and figure out the best way to approach the funeral because he really wanted to honor his her wishes. And ultimately, I think they settled on something really beautiful and we got the invitation and I just pulled it out because I loved the way that they balanced this. And I think that it's kind of a good starting point for anybody who's unfortunately on the other end of this conversation where they said, it is with indescribable grief and sorrow that we inform you of the ultimate passing of our beloved daughter and sister, so-and-so. Obviously, I'm not going to say any names. The memorial will begin with Jewish prayers to honor her parents' heritage, which will open a humanist service honoring her beliefs, which I think is a very kind of beautiful way, because when somebody is lost in their 20s, also the service is just as much for the family, for the parents. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, as
you're
it is
balancing
friends.
A lot of things. Yeah.
Kara, she was in her 20s.
Yeah, she was in her 20s. She's very young.
Terrible.
It's terrible. I didn't know her personally. You know, my friend is in his early 30s and it was his younger sister. But I do think that that's another consideration that we don't often think about. What were the wishes of the dearly departed? And what are the wishes of the family around them? Sometimes those things are at odds and there may be a way to find middle ground.
Yeah, be
so
respectful.
So the last moments in the most tense time possible, it's not about just staying on a high horse or trying to get your way.
Yeah. And I just want to emphasize that the point of the discussion was not to ridicule belief or anyone's faith. We don't gratuitously ridicule faith on this show. It was to talk about the reaction of the non-believers when – you know, people either just assume they don't exist or, you know, or are just thoughtless about the way that they're expressing their condolences. Mm-hmm. Further, the second point we made was it's also generally considered to be a mistake to console somebody by minimizing their loss. And again, the instinct is to say things like, well, you know, it's not that bad, you know, something to take it away. It's like, and you know what? That's actually it's interesting why that is our instinct, but it's one of those bad instincts that you should ignore. People don't need to be told that it's not as bad as it is. It is bad. It's horrible. You lost a loved one. They just need to be supported. Just say, I'm there for you. I'm sorry. What can I do for you? Don't say it'll be all right. It'll be okay. Whatever. Cause they don't say anything that diminishes their suffering or their mourning because that they need to work through it. So anyway, those are really the two points that we were making. It wasn't about ridiculing the faith itself. It was the response of non-believers when they are confronted with that, especially during a vulnerable and an emotionally vulnerable time, like when they're trying to process through a loss.
I think that's very good advice. And I would add to that, if you know anybody who is dealing with depression as well, that also applies.
Yeah.
Definitely trying to minimize it or telling people don't cry is probably not the most appropriate thing to do.
It's also
a situation.
It's a generic part of cultural sensitivity. Like, for example, a clerk at a store saying happy holidays. We're getting to war on Christmas time, everybody, right? Mm-hmm. So I actually had somebody – I know somebody who gets upset when somebody anonymous at a store says happy holidays. Like, they should say Merry Christmas. It's Christmas. It's like, well, they can't say Merry Christmas to everybody because some of their customers are going to be not Christian. And, you know, they will – what's wrong with saying season's greetings or happy holidays? It's generic. It recognizes that there are different people with different beliefs and different cultures and backgrounds. But again, it's an expression of privilege, I think. Like, my beliefs are dominant. I'm going to, as an expression of privilege, just assume everybody shares my beliefs. And if you don't, who cares? You're in the minority. Shut up.
Right. Yeah. Then there's a problem with you, not me.
And I do think you see that more in regions where, I mean, I'm from the South. I can say this. People do get offended more in the South if you don't say Merry Christmas. And the reason for that is because in the South, most people celebrate Christmas.
Yeah, right.
You know, when I was growing up, I met two Jews. I knew two Jews. And then I moved to New York and then I moved to LA and realized, oh, everybody's not Christian.
And then you met 2 million.
Exactly. And I think that that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, it's about where you're coming from too.
Yeah.
So, and not to say that that excuses it by any stretch of the imagination, but maybe think outside of the town you live in.
Yeah. I know people who
lives other places.
I know people who behave as if everybody shares their political party. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even occur to them that they may be talking to somebody who's of the other political party.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have 3 regular news items this week. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Here we go.
There we go.
Item number 1. Physicists have conducted the first loophole-free experiment proving that Einstein's local realism is not true and therefore either quantum non-locality or faster-than-light communication are real.
What? Oh boy.
Item number 2.
Come on, that was easy.
A recent mouse study finds that the cerebellum plays a critical role in the ability to ignore distractions. And item number 3. Scientists have demonstrated that the Rivulus fish, will leap out of the water and onto land for about a minute in order to cool down if the water temperature exceeds its acclimation. Jay, go first.
So the physicist one, that they say that they conducted this first loophole-free experiment. Kara, you got that so far?
No.
So I'll break it down for you. They did this loophole-free experiment that proved that Ian Steinzel, his local realism, it's not true. It's not true.
It's so broken down.
And therefore, in a quantum fashion, this non-locality or faster-than-light communications are real. They are possible, and one day we will be communicating with the internet in real time. So, hello, loophole-free experiment. Don't get it. Local realism. I think I keep it real pretty locally over here, so that's good. This quantum non-locality. Of course, Bob, this has something to do with you. And then the faster-than-light. I completely understand faster-than-light communication because seemingly there are times when my wife with precognition gets mad at me about things before I've done them. And then I actually do them. It's very strange. So I'm going to say that this one is absolutely science. The second one, the mouse study, the cerebellum is playing a critical role in the ability to ignore distractions. Apparently, I don't have a cerebellum. And I would, particularly in Star Wars season. So I would say that this one is probably science as well. And then finally, the scientists, these guys, they call themselves scientists. They demonstrate things. There's this rivulus fish who leaps out of the water and onto land for a brief minute. Just basically like, you know what? This water sucks. I want to, go on the dark side. And he does all of this because he wants to cool off. See, I think that one is true as well. So I have a problem.
Four.
And therefore.
All right. Well, I'm going to change my mind and say, you know what? I like the fish. I think fish do weird shit, and that's something that they probably do. It would be really cool if, the fish jumped out of the water and then, had a deadpan someone and go, and therefore, and then he jumps back in. I'm going to say that faster-than-light communication is not real, and that one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right, loophole-free experiment. Basically saying here that things like what Einstein called spooky action at a distance, quantum entanglement, is real, and my answer to that is duh. What I didn't know, what you're apparently saying here, is that they've done the first test, and they've done many tests, which is why this makes me think, well, what's new here? But it's the loophole free one, so I assume then that any of the experiments like Bell inequality and all that stuff, anything that was done in the past regarding that, had little tiny loopholes that didn't make it 100% ironclad and copper bottomed. So I could see that they finally concocted an experiment that just took away any assumptions at all. I could see that. All right, so the cerebellum, somehow the cerebellum plays a role in ignoring distractions. I don't understand. I mean, I don't know. The cerebellum, that's that little part of your little subbrain underneath your main brain, that little thing that's kind of tacked onto the bottom of it, that little tiny brain. But that's a lot of that. I mean, that has mainly to do with motor skills, I think. But there's also some other. Is there some cognition going on in there, or some kind of memory going on in there? I'm not sure how that is going to help with ignoring distractions, though. Doesn't quite make sense. That this rivulus fish jumping out of the water to cool down. How does he get back in the water? I'm sure there's lots of different ways that's possible. I'm going to go with the cerebellum one as a fiction. It's not quite. I could easily be wrong with that, but I'll say that's fiction.
All right, Evan.
Oh, well, obviously the one I know nothing about is the Einstein's one. This loophole-free experiment.
People don't listen to me.
Sorry, Bob. I mean, I try. Gosh, I try. And I do pick up lots of things from you here and there, but this one, I don't know. Faster than light communications are real, and therefore either quantum non-locality or faster than light.
Or FTL, yes.
The mouse study, the cerebellum plays a critical role in the ability to ignore distractions. Well, gee, I don't have a problem with this one. There are mouse studies every day coming out all, but who knows? This probably still need to validate it. I'll say that one's science. The rivulus fish, which I had never heard of before, leaps out of water for about a minute and cools down. So I don't know, fish or Einstein.
Come on, Evan, join me. Please don't let me be alone this week.
All right, Jay, you convinced me. I'm going to go with Jay. I'll say the Einstein quantum non-locality faster than light one is fiction.
And Kara.
I'm going to say, I don't know if this will be the only time I ever do this, but Bob, ditto to everything you said. The mouse study finding that the cerebellum plays a critical role in the ability to ignore distractions would be insane to me if this is true, because the cerebellum is mostly involved in motor control. When I think of distraction, I think of attention. I think of the frontal lobe. I think of integrative areas of the cortex. I do not think of the cerebellum. If this is true, it's kind of blowing my mind, which is why I want to say that this is the fiction. And the rivulus fish, all I got to say to that is like climate change, yo. It's pretty sad. So I'm going to go with Bob.
Okay, so you all agree in the third one that scientists have demonstrated that the rivulus fish will leap out of the water and onto land for about a minute in order to cool down if the water temperature exceeds its acclimation. You all think that one is true, and that one is science.
Yay.
Yep, that's not terribly amazing. It's cool. This is an amphibious fish. That makes it a lot more plausible when you throw that bit in there.
A tad.
Yeah. But the real the study, so they kind of knew that this was happening. That wasn't the big part. They wanted to know if the fish are responding more to the temperature of the water during their development or the more recent temperature of the water to which they are acclimated. And they showed that when they choose to leap out of the water to cool off depends on what temperature they're acclimated to. It doesn't matter what the temperature of the water was when they were developing. So that was one question. And then the other question was, what's the mechanism of cooling? And what they did in the experiment, they sort of leapt out onto this filter paper where they could actually measure their temperature. And they showed that they cool by evaporative cooling. They could actually get cooler than the surrounding air. It's a very efficient method for cooling down, and they do that because the water's too hot. These are like tropical fish, you know, so the rivers can get too warm. And Carrie, you're right. They mentioned that they may need to develop this flexibility more so as the climate warms. That this is actually, you know, a good skill to have, you know, to be this what they call reversible plasticity or flexibility in their ability to tolerate temperatures and to cool themselves off when the temperatures exceed their tolerance. So yeah, so that one is science. And again, yeah, the bit, knowing that they're amphibious fish helps. Here's a word for you, Kara. What do you call it when an amphibious fish leaves the water?
Dinner.
They immerse. E-M-E-R-S-E.
Oh, cool.
It's like immigration and emigration.
Yeah, oh, I like that.
Gotcha. Oh. Egress. And
immerse.
Egress. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to number one. Physicists have conducted the first loophole-free experiment proving that Einstein's local realism is not true and therefore either quantum non-locality or fashion light communication are real. Bob and Kara think this one is science. Jay and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. I know you guys don't like when I do this, but I'm going to explain the background of this before I give you the answer.
It's fascinating. Because
I don't know what it means at all.
Yeah. Let me explain it to you so you know what the answer means. So you know that one of the implications of quantum mechanics is that you have two particles, like two electrons, two photons, whatever, that are entangled in some way.
Mm-hmm. That I know.
That means that you can describe something about them with one single equation, essentially.
Here's a good analogy I just thought of. You have a system that weighs 11 pounds. You split it into two separate systems, and then you find one is 6 pounds. The other one has to be 5. There's no other way around it. They're one unit, even if they're separated by a billion light years. You could still describe them with one equation. So they're essentially one system that just happens to be separated by a huge, vast amount of space.
That analogy breaks down because
it's not perfect. It's not perfect for
sure. But it's interesting. Why it breaks down is interesting because the question is, so that's basically been demonstrated now. There's no question that like if one particle is spin up, the other is spin down.
Right.
They are connected. You can describe you can't tell which one's going to be spin up and which one's going to be spin down, but you know that if one is spin up, the other is spin down.
Has to be.
That's the entanglement. So that's how you could describe their spin, not in detail, but one equation could describe their collective spin. And then there's a random element, and this is where the analogy breaks down, Bob. So what Einstein was saying was that, well, it's not that they're communicating with each other, and it's not that their properties are non-local. It's that there's just some deeper reality we're not
hidden
aware
variables.
Of.
Hidden
variables. There's some hidden, deeper reality, hidden variables that is determining both of their spins. And the spins are essentially already there and are responding to this deeper reality we haven't figured out yet. This was the local realism solution to this observation of entanglement without invoking the quantum weirdness. And there are those who have been clinging to this local realism.
Really?
In order, even to today, in order to avoid having to say that reality either violates the speed of light or is non-local. So there have been a number of experiments demonstrating this entanglement property. The problem is that none of the experiments have been loophole free. The meaning
well, that means this is
like, for
science.
example, it's possible that the two particles are communicating to each other in some way at less than the speed of light. And so you can't rule out ordinary communication if they are close together or if the time frame of the experiment is slow enough. If it takes you a certain amount of time to take your measurement, the two particles could have secretly communicated with each other in that time. And there you go. That blows your experiment. So that's one of the loopholes. Then the more you try to fix one problem, the harder the other problem gets. So the loop, no big researchers couldn't figure out a way to completely simultaneously eliminate all loopholes from that experiment. And physicists have been racing to do just that. And indeed, the first team has successfully completed the first loophole-free experiment of entanglement.
Does that mean we were right? Is true?
Hang on. Yeah. I didn't tell you what the results of the experiment are.
Shit.
Jay, I think we're wrong.
So, hold on. So this was a group led by Ronald Hansen at Delft University.
Oh, that guy.
Hey, Ron.
And they used these diamonds separated by 1.3 kilometers, and then they send photons to a detector. And the idea is if by chance, if two photons arrive at exactly the same moment, it'll entangle electrons that emitted those photons in these two diamonds separated by 1.3 kilometers. And so if that happens,
that's faster than light.
Then either those electrons are non-local or they have communicated with each other faster than the speed of light.
What happened?
One of those two things has to happen. So the question was, are they going to be able to measure this entanglement, right? Are they going to be able to demonstrate this? And they did. So they confirmed. This is science. They confirmed.
Of course they did.
That.
So amateurs.
Einstein's local realism is definitively disproved.
Yeah.
So either the entanglement demonstrates spooky action at a distance or they are communicating at faster than the speed of light. I agree with you, Bob. I think it's the spooky action at a distance.
Sure.
I don't think it's the speed of light being violated. but we don't know.
Sure.
This experiment doesn't distinguish those two scenarios because one of them has to be true. That's all the experiment proves.
Yeah, to me, this is like an experiment finally 100% proving that acupuncture does not exist. Well, no shit. But it's nice to get those last few decimal points so that nobody that's rational can have anything to say. That's fine. But I did read this, but this was an easy one for me, obviously, because I've read about this shit a lot. So it didn't matter that I even read it. But as I was reading it, I was thinking, yeah, no shit. What's the new stuff? What's the new stuff? And then I was like, oh, okay. I wasn't really aware that there were tiny little loopholes that were still existing, and it's nice that they got rid of them. Yeah,
so you read this story, basically you cheated, and you're saying Einstein's a dunce is all in the same.
Einstein didn't want to give dice to God. You know, God does not play dice with the universe.
Right. About this, he was clearly wrong.
He was wrong. He was wrong. Very ironically wrong, too, because Einstein's genius earlier in his career was thinking outside the box, even though I hate that term, in this way, in that, you know, the evidence was showing that the speed of light is constant and that time and distance are variable. And Einstein was the first one to go, that's the way the universe works, folks.
Right.
It's not just a mathematical trick. It's not just, you know, something, there's not some deeper reality here. That's the reality. And then he fell for the same exact thing when he was older in his career. And even though the experiments were saying non-locality, he couldn't accept it. And he said, there's got to be some fix to this. And, but ironic. No, he was wrong.
Right. Right. And here, another good example, Steve, maybe not as dramatic as this one, but another one was that when he was going through relativity, his theory was saying that the universe was either expanding or contracting. But since everyone believed that it was a static universe, he wouldn't buy it. And that's where the cosmological constant was as a fudge factor was plugged in. And he, you know, as awesome as he was, it would have been such a nice extra feather in his cap to the other thousand that he already had if he was the first to show theoretically that the universe must be expanding. Oh, that would have been so sweet. But hey, we'll send it. You know, he didn't get that one, but that's fine. That's
fine. And he called that his biggest blunder of his career.
But what I learned from this one is that if it's a science or fiction about quantum mechanics, always listen to Bob.
99% maybe. or maybe 91.
Mm-hmm. Always listen to Bob over now, Jay or Evan.
I have to get
Yes,
that's for sure.
On a quantum mechanics one. All right. Which means that a recent mouse study finds that the cerebellum plays a critical role in the ability to ignore distractions is the fiction. And Bob and Carrie, you are correct because the cerebellum was the dumbest choice I can come up with for the fake because it just has nothing to do with this. So Kara, as the other neuroscientist on the panel, so there was a mouse study which did show that one part of the brain plays a critical role in the ability to ignore distractions. What was it?
I'm going to go with the part of the brain that controls almost everything, the thalamus.
You're correct.
The thalamus. Oh, nice.
Wow, nice.
Guys,
wow,
if in doubt, always pick thalamus. Kara. If in doubt.
Bob, for me, when I read this study, that was like, no, duh. Of course it's the thalamus. That's what the thalamus does. This isn't new. The thalamus is the relay center for all of your sensory input, and that's exactly what it does. So, in fact, there is a clinical syndrome, Kara, I don't know if you know about this, but if people have bilateral thalamic lesions, doesn't happen that often because strokes usually will affect one side or the other. Mm-hmm. But if somehow you get a lesion of both of your thalami, then you look like you're locked in, or that you're comatose, mm-hmm. but you're conscious. It's just that you have absolutely no way of filtering out your sensory input.
Oh, geez. And so because everything starts in.
Imagine all sensory input has equal pull on your attention.
Except for smell. Smell would be the only thing you had, right? Because the smell bypasses the thalamus.
But you can't communicate to the people with smell. So when you're like standing over the patient's bed talking to them, your voice is no more interesting to them than any other random noise But if you scream in their face, you can blast through that.
You can get their attention
if you just overwhelm their sensory input by screaming in their face.
But is it autism or some other?
So the authors said that this may give us some insight into other things where the ability to parse your sensory input is playing a role. It doesn't necessarily mean that autism has its roots in the thalamus,
similar in that regard.
But we'll see. People with autism, their cells don't communicate with each other as robustly as more typical, neurotypical people do. So that may be more of a distributed phenomenon, not localized to the thalamus. But I had the exact same response you had, Kara, when I read this. I'm like, yeah, of course it's the thalamus. I mean, what else would it be? That's what the thalamus does. We're always told like the thalamus is the relay, the switching board of your of your brain. You know, that's where everything goes through the thalamus, and that's where it sends it on to the different parts of the brain that it's supposed to go to, and it has a critical role to play in filtering.
I should have seen that Pixar movie this summer.
Yeah, that wouldn't have helped.
Evan, I'm sorry. But,
it's all right. It's not the first time you've dragged me into the depths of something.
Let him astray. Okay. So, Evan, give us the quote of the week.
No way of thinking or doing, however ancient, can be trusted without proof. Henry David Thoreau.
Thoreau.
And Henry David Thoreau was an American author, poet, philosopher, abolitionist, naturalist, tax resister, development critic, surveyor, and historian. And a leading transcendentalist, Unitarian Church and all that.
Yeah, I like that quote.
I do as well.
Short and sweet. Carrie, you have an announcement?
I do. I have an announcement, and I want to pull it up so that I get everything right. So I am excited to announce that I will be co-hosting the first ever live brain surgery on television this Sunday, October 25th. So the show usually, this show, SGU, usually goes up on Saturday. So tomorrow, if you're listening the day we went live, it will be at 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 Central on National Geographic. And if you do not live in the United States, you will still very likely have a chance to watch it because it is simulcast live in something like 150 countries in 40 different languages all over the world. Bryant Gumbel is hosting, and I will be co-hosting along with Dr. Raoul Jandial, and we will be providing the commentary while two neurosurgeons, actually may even be three neurosurgeons, do a deep brain stimulation surgery on a patient with Parkinson's disease.
That is cool.
Wow.
Very cool. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's been a lot of work. It's a 2-hour live event. We taped a lot of stuff in advance, but it's going to be pretty crazy. They said it's 100 people in the crew, a massive truck out on the street, the camera truck with a bunch of switchers and lots of people working. So it should be awesome.
I will be at UConn on November 2nd, Monday, November 2nd, starting at 5:30. They're at the Skeptics Forum. It's a panel discussion. I'm not sure if it's going to be more of a debate. I'm going to be talking with astronomer Hugh Ross and biochemist Faisal Rana, two creationists, about the title of it is Big Faith or Big Bang. You know, and it's more about cosmology, like the origin of the universe, then evolution, I think. But we'll see. I think it's going to be about both. I've written about Hugh Ross before. He basically uses the anthropic principle to argue that the universe had to have been designed, created. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So, yeah, it should be fun. So if you're in the Hartford area, this is at the UConn Hartford campus, 5:30 p.m. Monday, November 2nd.
Nice.
Yeah, should be fun. All right, guys. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Yes, sir.
You're welcome,
sure,
Doctor.
Sure, man.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.